From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. In 1 year's time, the writer Edwige Danticat gave birth to her first child and lost her father and her uncle who helped raise her in Haiti. Her uncle died in American custody while seeking temporary asylum after his church in Haiti was destroyed and his life threatened. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Danticat about her new memoir, Brother, I'm Dying. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews the new album by the McCoy Tyner Quartet, and critic-at-large John Powers has some thoughts on watching the 40th anniversary edition of The Graduate, a film he hasn't seen since high school. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Edwige Dantecot, is a Haitian-born writer who has been a finalist for the National Book Award, the Pen Faulkner Award, and the National Book Critics Circle Award. She's the winner of an American Book Award. Her new memoir is about the year her father died in New York and her uncle died in American custody while trying to seek temporary asylum after his church in Haiti was attacked and his life was threatened. That same year, Dantecot gave birth to her daughter. In the course of the book, we learn about Dantecot's upbringing in Haiti, her new life in America, recent political upheaval in Haiti, and problems in the American immigration system. Her memoir is called Brother, I'm Dying. Reviewing it in the New York Times, Michiko Kakutani wrote, "It embodies the painful legacy of Haiti's violent history, demonstrating the myriad ways in which the public and the private, the political and the personal, intersect in the lives of that country's citizens and exiles." She has written a fierce, haunting book about exile and loss and family love. Edwige Dantecot, welcome to Fresh Air. I'd like you to start by reading the opening of Brother, I'm Dying.
I found out I was pregnant the same day that my father's rapid weight loss and chronic shortness of breath were positively diagnosed as end-stage pulmonary fibrosis. It was a hot morning in July 2004. I took a 6:30 a.m. flight from Miami to accompany my father on a visit to a pulmonologist at Brooklyn's Coney Island Hospital that afternoon. I had planned to catch up on my sleep during the flight, but cramping in my lower abdomen kept me awake. I interpreted the cramps as a sign of worry for my father. In the past few months, his breathing had grown labored and loud, and he'd been hospitalized 3 times. During his most recent hospital stay, he had been referred to a pulmonologist who'd since performed a new battery of tests. My father picked me up at the airport at 9 a.m. We hadn't seen each other in a month. 2 years before, in August 2002, I had married and moved to Miami, where my then-fiancé was living. Fearing my father's disapproval, I hadn't announced my intention to leave New York until a month before the wedding, when my father summoned me to his room for a chat. "How can you leave New York?" he asked while filling out a check on top of a book on his lap. Back then, he was still healthy yet lanky, with a body that looked and moved like an aging dancer's, a receding hairline, and half a head of salt and pepper hair. Removing his steel-rimmed bifocals so I could better see his ember eyes, he had added in his slow, scratchy voice, "Your mother's here in Brooklyn, I'm here, 2 of your 3 brothers are here, you have no family in Miami. What if this man you're moving there for mistreats you? Who are you going to turn to?" The lecture ended with his handing me the equivalent of 5 months of his mortgage payments towards the wedding reception cost. Looking back now, I wish he'd simply said, "Don't go, I'm going to get sick, and I might die."
That's Edwige Dantecot reading from the opening of her new memoir, Brother, I'm Dying. When you knew that you were pregnant and your father was dying, your father didn't know either of those things. The doctor didn't tell him how serious his condition was, and you decided to wait before telling him that you were pregnant. So it must have been odd, difficult, strange to know these two profound things that your father didn't know.
Yeah, it was very strange because I think the person who would have been, at least besides my husband, I think, who would have been the happiest for me, and then the person who would have been the saddest about his news was not aware of either of those things. But in that time, it felt a little bit like a protective bubble for him, because I felt like he, one, would for him have sort of made the other harder to take. Because he had always, you know, I'd been married for about 3 years before I became pregnant. So, and he was always nudging me on the subject, and so it was a bit. Both would have been a big deal, and I didn't know how to approach him. And we've always had him and me sort of a difficulty just having these kinds of conversations. So it was hard to imagine having this very one with him.
Your Uncle Joseph had been a pastor in Haiti. And he raised you because your parents left Haiti. Your father left when you were 2. Your mother left when you were 4. And it took 8 years before they were able to bring you and your brother to New York where they had lived. Why were they unable to take you with them when they moved to New York?
Well, when my father moved in 1971, they didn't know anyone in New York except a cousin that we had there. So my dad didn't realize what was going to happen. He didn't know what it would be like. They had never been. And so he went first to sort of see what it would be like. And then my mother's brother moved to New York in the meantime, and so she went. They just felt that they would be working very hard and they wouldn't have any place to leave us. They felt like it was better to leave us with relatives in Haiti so that we could have at least a familiar environment and family around us in a kind of community that we were used to.
What did your parents feel that they had to leave Haiti?
Well, my father left because he was working in a shoe store where he didn't get paid very much, but he had the extra menace of having the Tonton Macoutou, or the henchmen of the Duvalier regime, who came in and always wanted free shoes. And he just, I mean, it sounds like a trivial thing, but he really, standing between them and these shoes was life-threatening for him. And so at some point, just the pressure and wanting a better life, he decided to leave.
Did your parents later, when you were older and when you were reunited, talk with you about the difficulty of leaving you and your brother behind?
Well, I remember when I was a teenager having my sort of a momentary rebellion. And I, you know, my mother one time was trying to help me with some laundry, and I said something to her like, I can do this, you know, I've learned to take care of myself since I was a kid. And so she kind of sensed sort of where that was going, and we had a conversation where she said something that I didn't put in the book, but I'd just never forgotten, where she said, well, you know, every time I sat down to eat, I wondered if you guys were eating, and every time I put myself to bed, I wondered how you were sleeping. And to this day, you know, that still makes me teary. But that's the one conversation we had about it, and I felt like I understood. And being a parent now, certainly you understand the great toll, the emotional toll it would take to be separated from your child.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Edwige Dantecott, and her new family memoir is called Brother, I'm Dying. Your uncle, the uncle who raised you along with your aunt, he was a pastor in a neighborhood in Port-au-Prince, Haiti. Would you describe his church?
Well, his church was called L'Église Chrétienne de la Rédemption, the Christian Church of Redemption, and it was in a neighborhood in Haiti called Bel Air. And it's now one of those neighborhoods that whenever people talk about, you know, violence in Haiti or gangs, et cetera, that they cite. But when he first moved there from the countryside in the 1940s, was a beautiful area. It was just almost like a hilly neighborhood with trees and so forth. And that's where he settled and spent the next 30 years of his life. And my uncle started this church after leaving politics. He was an aspiring politician. He was very much enthralled by a man named Daniel Fignolet, who was a populist, who was very involved in the needs of the poor. And that's the before Duvalier came into power, that's the person he supported. So once Fignolet was deposed after 3 weeks in power, my uncle decided to become a Christian and started training to become a pastor, and started this church in Bel Air.
Your uncle had a radical laryngectomy for a tumor, and he lost his voice. Eventually, he got a voice box that enabled him to communicate. But did that put a strain on your relationship because you couldn't talk to each other? I mean, you could talk to him, but he couldn't respond to you vocally.
Well, I was still in Haiti after he had his surgery. I was about 9 when he came back. And the interesting thing was that I felt that people felt so sorry for him. Suddenly imagine a preacher who no longer can speak. But he took it very well. I think he found other ways to communicate. He wrote an awful lot of notes. He always had pads in which he would write notes to communicate with people. And he designed a kind of his own type of sign language when he needed to say something. And he seemed to us like the same person, so there was no strain. The only thing that was different is that he would sometimes get frustrated. You know, you could see a kind of frustration on his face when he was talking to people and they didn't understand him. But there was more of a tenderness than a strain, because suddenly he needed us, especially the children among us. He needed us in a way that he hadn't before, so that if he were going to some place where he knew that his handwriting may not be understood, or the sign language, or the other ways that he had designed to communicate with people, and if he were going to be around strangers, he would ask us to go with him, and I would go with him often, or my brother or my cousin would go with him. And so there we developed a different kind of relationship, because we began to get these different little glimpses into his world, you know, when he goes to the education ministry for the school or to the bank, and we were with him a lot more after the surgery, because we were helping people understand what he wanted to say.
My guest is Edwige Dantecott. Her new memoir is called Brother, I'm Dying. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Edwige Dantecott, and her new book is a memoir. It's a family memoir called Brother, I'm Dying. You came to the United States, to New York, at the age of 12 after being separated from your parents for 8 years. They had to prove that they'd be able to support you. You and your brother had to prove that you were well enough to enter the United States, and you were diagnosed with inactive TB, so you had to wait a few months till that passed. So when you finally were reunited with your parents after 8 years, did they seem like parents or strangers to you?
They seemed like super parents and strangers at the same time. I think all children, you know, sort of imagine these other parents that we have, you know, even children who are with their parents think, oh, there must be these cool people somewhere who are my real parents.
Right.
And this was, you know, fueled by also people saying, oh, you know, you'll have more clothes, you'll have more milk, you'll have more money when you finally are with your parents. So I think there's inevitably when you finally are with these parents who are ordinary people, a kind of disappointment. They didn't feel like strangers because I think they were trying very hard, our parents, to be so warm or to make up this gap. But they didn't feel certainly like the, you know, the super parents we had imagined. You know, they for example, the day after we got there, they had to get up very early for work, and I don't know whatever sort of ceremonies we had rehearsed in our minds was hard for them to live up to. But they were, we knew that they were our parents. We knew that they were now taking care of us. But it takes a little while to even say the words, you know, to say mama or papa. At first, it sounds strange to say directly to them as opposed to saying it in conversations about them.
So the neighborhood that your parents were living in that became your home was in Brooklyn. The apartment was right off Flatbush Avenue. Would you describe what was most strange to you about your new home and your new neighborhood?
Well, it's the strangest thing was that we didn't know anybody. And my parents, who they had lived there for many years, and there were a lot of people in the building who attended the same church as them. But we were suddenly in this place, going from the neighborhood in Haiti, where my uncle had been for many, many years and where we knew everyone. And suddenly we didn't know anyone. And I remember also marveling at the fact that everyone had sort of, it was an apartment building, so there were these, all these doors lined up, and they were shut, you know, and we didn't know who lived behind them. And they seemed somewhat, you know, prison-like, all these doors in apartment buildings. I immediately felt like I lost the openness of the neighborhood where we lived. And I remember thinking, you know, seeing the fire escape and, of course, not knowing what it was and thinking that it was just this wrought iron balcony where we could hang out and look over the train tracks behind the building, but that my father quickly told us was for fires. And things like that, I think, just suddenly feeling that, yeah, this is a very, very different life. I have a friend who says that, you know, when you're small like that and you come to the United States from a place like Haiti, that it's almost like time travel, and you just feel like you've landed in a whole different, an entirely different planet. And it's certainly how it felt. Like this was really a very different place.
When you came to Brooklyn, where did you see yourself as fitting in racially? Did you feel like African-Americans felt connected or disconnected from you? Do you know what I mean? That they saw you as being different because you were from Haiti?
Well, I was different because I didn't speak English, you know. And also when I did speak, I spoke with an accent for most of my New York life, if you will. And also there was, in the beginning, it was hard to communicate even with the children at school. Mm-hmm. And there were so many misconceptions for some of those students too about us being from Haiti. It was 1981, and it was a time when a lot of Haitians were just coming to the United States in this very loud media wave by boat, and it was making the news all the time. And people were just beginning to talk about AIDS, and every night on the nightly news you would hear that, you know, there were these high-risk groups and Haitians, hemophiliacs and others were, you know, we were one of the five high-risk groups. So that didn't make it easy for going to school. And of course, we were taunted by not just the African-American students, but also the other Caribbean groups. I think because we stood out, you know, I stood out as a Haitian student because of language, but also because of these things that were in the news all the time. So we were picked on for that.
Your father drove a gypsy cab, which means he wasn't affiliated with like a taxi cab company. It was his own car. And, you know, he was independent in that sense. Would you describe the car that was the family car and the taxi?
Well, there were several. The first one was this station wagon. So that was sort of bluish gray. And it had the livery sticker back then attached to the back so that people would know that it was a cab. And we went around in that. It was a little bit, you know, beat up. And my dad had just at that time left a factory job. When he had to come pick us up at the airport when we came from Haiti, he asked his boss at the factory where he was working if he could leave early. And the boss said no. And so he was fired the very day that we came. And he decided after that to drive this car that he had as a livery cab. And over the years, he had had other ones. But he always drove the same car that we always sort of piled up in the livery cab as our family car. And he, until he died, did not have another car because he would say, you know, we would try to convince him to get, you know, just a smaller car, especially when it was just him and my mother that he was in working in. And he would say, you know, his reason was always that insurance is very high for cab drivers. So getting the personal car and the gypsy cab, it was just too much trouble and too much money. And so he always drove the same. So we were sometimes like, my brothers and I would play, pretend that we were passengers sometimes in the cab, and, you know, would tease him that way, and we sort of made a game of it.
Your father came to the United States in part because of the dangers he faced in Haiti from the Tonton Macoute, the militia. But he faced dangers as a cab driver in New York.
Oh, absolutely. And I think, you know, my father would, he would always want to tell us like not to exaggerate the dangers he faced, because there were people who were actually in dungeons and jails in Haiti, and he felt like his dealings, you know, his confrontations with the Tohono were mild compared to those people who disappeared, just were vanished and killed. But when he actually got here, when he started driving the gypsy cab, he had what they call a partition, what was supposed to be a bulletproof wall between him and the passenger in this family car cab that we all were in all the time. But he had several run-ins, you know, with people, because he on Saturday mornings especially, he would leave very early to try to catch some of the, you know, the club going crowds in Brooklyn, and he had incidents where people didn't pay, where someone hit him with a crowbar, where the car was shot at, and he never told us. My parents were part of this prayer circle, and they would come to the house every once in a while, but usually on Mondays. And we would all, my brothers and I, would all eagerly await the next report of sort of the previous Saturday morning. And sometimes they were horrific. I mean, once we knew, there was one time where we had to, after he was hit by the crowbar, where we had to go to the emergency room with him. But other than that, a lot of the horrific things that happened in the cab, he always tried to keep away from us.
Edwige Dantecott's new memoir is called Brother, I'm Dying. We'll talk more about it in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics Edition of the Aeneid, Virgil's Epic of the Founding of Rome, in stores and online at bn.com. From Carpenter Company, maker of bed pillows and other innovative products designed to help people sleep better. Z-score test and sleep tips available at carpenter.com. And from the Wallace Foundation, supporting ideas, sharing solutions, expanding opportunities, on the web at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Hello, darkness, my old friend.
Coming up, John Powers on the 40th Anniversary Edition DVD of The Graduate. After watching it for the first time in decades, he saw some things that escaped him as a teenager. Also, Kevin Whitehead reviews a new CD by the McCoy Tyner Quartet, and we continue our interview with writer Edwige Dantecott.
That was planted in my brain, still remains within the sound of silence. In restless dreams I walked alone, narrow streets of cobblestone. Beneath the halo of a street lamp, I turned my collar to the cold and damp. When my eyes were stared by the flash of a neon light, to split the night and touch the sound of silence. And in the naked light I saw 10,000 people, maybe more. People talking without speaking. People hearing without listening.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with writer Edwige Dantecott. Her new memoir, Brother, I'm Dying, is about the year she gave birth to her daughter. Her father died in New York, and her uncle Joseph died in American custody while trying to seek temporary asylum after his church in Haiti was attacked and his life was threatened. Edwige Dantecott grew up in Haiti. Her parents moved to New York when she was 2, but they couldn't afford to bring her and her brother to live with them until Edwige was 12. In the interim, she was raised in Haiti by her uncle Joseph and Aunt Denise. after you moved to New York, years after you moved to New York, your uncle had to flee Haiti. This was like in 2004. And your uncle, again, had been a pastor in Haiti, where he founded a church in his neighborhood. Why did he have to leave?
Well, he had to leave because in October 2004, there was sort of a multitude of things happening. President Aristide had been driven out of Haiti earlier in the year, and it was coming up on the anniversary of the first time that he was deposed by the military, and there were demonstrations pretty much, you know, everywhere, but especially in Bel Air, which is usually a big starting point for demonstrations. And also there was a growing gang problem, and especially in the neighborhood. So the transitional government there had requested, there was a UN operation there called MINUSTA, a Brazil-led force that was already in the country. And so they were often, and they lasted for a very long time, these sort of forays into neighborhoods like Bel Air and Cité Soleil, which is another often volatile neighborhood, by the Haitian riot police and the UN. They would just storm these neighborhoods and try to go at the gangs, you know, to try to, because often, as in Bel Air, the gang would sort of cordon off the neighborhood. And so on that Sunday morning on October 2004, the Haitian riot police and the UN came into his neighborhood, and they climbed on top of his church because it's a higher building in the neighborhood, and they shot at people from there. And after they left, the gangs came and threatened my uncle, and he had to go into hiding, and he had to flee.
So your uncle fled Haiti, flew to Miami, where he requested temporary political asylum. He ended up being detained there, and he died in custody. You wonder in the book why he applied for asylum instead of just using his visa. What have you come to think about the answer to that?
Well, it's one of those questions that I suppose I will never be able to answer, because he had been coming to the United States since the 1970s, and had made several trips, and he had a visa that would have expired in 2008 with multiple entries. He had been coming and going for so many years here, and even this trip that he was on was already planned. He had been planning to come that October to Miami, and when things got this way, he just decided to come. So I don't know why, when he got here, he asked for asylum. I can only guess that, and from the conversations with my cousin who was with him, he was asked how long he would be staying, and he had pretty much lost everything. Part of the church had been burned. All his things had been ransacked, and he had nothing to go back to. And I think he wanted to just rally here for a while, and he said that he wanted to stay a little bit longer than the visa allowed. And so he was immediately arrested and put at the Combe Detention Center, where his medication was taken, and he fell ill and died.
Why was he arrested, and why was his medication taken?
I don't know exactly why he was arrested. I've been told, after that it is the policy to, if someone requests asylum, that they are detained. But it is from the documents that I've reviewed, also at the discretion of the customs authority who interviews that person, as my uncle was interviewed at the airport, or by all the people at the point of entry who make that decision. They could have decided, for example, to release him and request that he apply from outside of the airport, or they could have paroled him. They could have given him a humanitarian parole, given the fact that he was 81 years old and was frail. And this was all at the discretion of the people he encountered at the point of entry. But he was detained.
What do you know about how he died?
What I know about how he died, I called from documents that we got through the Freedom of Information Act from the government, and some of them were the internal memos and documents from the airport, documents from the Qom Detention Center. There was also an investigation by the Inspector General of the Department of Homeland Security, which had some of the interviews with the people involved. What I know is that the day before he died, had what is called a credible fear interview before an immigration judge at Qom, and that he, during the interview, before he went into the interview, he told the lawyer who was representing him that they had taken his medication, that he was not feeling well, but that he went into the interview anyway. And while he was being questioned, he began vomiting. It seemed like he was having a type of seizure. He was accused, and this is in the government papers, too, the records, he was accused of a faking by the medic who felt that he had seen this before, and he had seen many people fake. But still, he was given some care at Qom, and his condition deteriorated. He was taken to Jackson Memorial Hospital, where he died 24 hours later.
My guest is Edwige Dantecott. Her new memoir is called Brother, I'm Dying. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Edwige Dantecott, and her new book is a memoir about her family and also about her childhood. She grew up in Haiti. Her parents went to the United States 8 years before being able to bring their children with them, so she was raised by her uncle and aunt. Her new memoir, Brother, I'm Dying, is in part about the year in which she became pregnant and her uncle died and her father died. When your father was dying, your brother asked if your father had enjoyed his life. And your father's answer was, and I'm going to quote the book here, your father said, "You, my children, have not shamed me. I'm proud of that. It could have been so different. Edwige and Bob, your mother and I left you behind for 8 years in Haiti. Kelly and Carl, you grew up here in a country your mother and I didn't know very well when we had you. You all could have turned bad, but you didn't." What was your reaction when he said that?
Oh, I was just stunned. I think we were all crying in our own way by then. I just felt the load of his life, you know, that the fact that he had sacrificed so much for us. And my parents, you know, never went on a vacation. It's sort of the typical, I think, first-generation immigrant paradigm. And there was just so much that he hadn't done. And I worried at that moment and moments afterwards, you know, whether he had always been underestimating the value of his life. But I realized that this was his focus and that he decided that was the purpose of his life, to see that we did okay. And I know he was not unique in that, in the sense that, you know, a lot of this is why a lot of immigrant parents made the journey. So it was a moment of extraordinary sadness for me, just realizing that all that his, you know, that part of his life had all been focused on us. And at the same time, you feel, you know, the sense of, you know, this debt that you can never, ever repay.
Your father lived long enough to see your new baby daughter. You write that when your daughter was born into the world, you thought of your father's transition out of the world. And I'd really love to hear more about those thoughts, about your thoughts about the transition out of the world.
Well, my father was so, it seemed to us, I don't know what his darker moments alone were, but whenever we were with him, he just seemed so at ease with what was happening, that he had accepted it, and sometimes, you know, we worried that he was almost waiting to die. But he was also waiting very eagerly to meet my daughter, and he would, when we spoke on the phone, he would always say, "I want to see the firstborn of my firstborn," this kind of thing. So I was at this point where I had learned from him, and I think that's the greatest lesson he wanted to teach us, to accept what was happening to him and to sort of weave what was happening to me into it, the fact that it would comfort him to see my daughter, and that I felt, you know, in this way that he was waiting to meet her. And so I was always thinking, every time I thought of my daughter coming into the world, I thought of him going out of it, and primarily because I worried so much that that wouldn't happen, that they wouldn't have had time. And after she was born, we couldn't get her right on the plane to New York because she was not gaining weight. And so there was sort of the eagerness of every day of until she was able to fly and meet him. So when they met, it just felt, I mean, it sounds, you know, just sort of cliched or whatever, but this feeling that a circle was full, and a circle in the sense that because he so wanted to meet her and I so wanted her to at least have touched him. And so it felt like a transition, you know, sort of certainly a generational shift, but also this transition for my father, which I think began his process of fully letting go.
You write in your book that you wish you had some guarantee about the afterlife. What are your thoughts about what's happened to your father and your uncle?
Well, I like to think that they're together somewhere, perhaps in the place that they were born, or place of their own imaginings. You know, they were both religious men, and so I'd like to think that they're both in their own heaven.
Do you believe that? Are you a religious person too?
I grew up in the church, so I share those beliefs, but I also, you know, think of alternative ways that we end life or that we are afterlife. So I have a wide range of places where I can imagine them, or I can imagine myself when my time comes.
Do you dream about your father and your uncle? And when you do, what age are they? And are they sick or are they healthy?
I dream about them very often, and they're always healthy. I recently had a dream about my father, and we were simply having coffee. So I often have dreams like that where we do things that perhaps we'd never done before together. But I always dream of my uncle and my father separately, or I have so far.
Well, Edwidge Dantecott, it's been great to talk with you. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Edwidge Dantecott's new memoir is called Brother, I'm Dying. McCoy Tyner is one of the most influential jazz pianists of the last 40 years, alongside Herbie Hancock and Bill Evans. Tyner played in John Coltrane's quartet in the 1960s and has been leading his own groups ever since. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says, "Tyner's sound is so pervasive, it's easy to take for granted, but a new quartet recording makes his virtues sound fresh again."
McCoy Tyner on piano with Joe Lovano on tenor saxophone. The tune is Walk Spirit, Talk Spirit, a Tyner oldie with a hint of John Coltrane's A Love Supreme in the bass. Tyner's style hasn't evolved much since he played with Coltrane in the 1960s. By then, the pianist had already developed his signature style, big, billowing open harmonies that support a band without hemming it in. On the bandstand, he creates an environment where different rhythms and chords can be piled one on another without canceling each other out. The sound is a big tent with plenty of elbow room. The pianist's new album on his own new label is modestly titled McCoy Tyner Quartet. Another leader might have called them his all-stars. Besides Lovano on tenor, he's got the powerhouse rhythm section of bassist Christian McBride and drummer Jeff Tane Watts. They all sound happy to be together, feeding off each other's energy on this club date from last New Year's. McCoy Tyner is good at filling up sonic space and covering the high and low frequencies. But every once in a while, this piano maximalist may put you in mind of minimalists like Count Basie or Thelonious Monk. He knows sometimes the best thing for a pianist to do behind a soloist is nothing at all, letting bass and drums carry the load. Tyner might keep a low profile even when he sneaks back in behind Joe Lovano. McCoy Tyner can sound almost gentle sometimes. He's got it right now that he's nearing 70. But he can still make piano ring like nobody else, his umpteen imitators included. And since his style never broke, he had the good sense not to fix it. It's as timeless as thunder.
Kevin Whitehead teaches English and American Studies at the University of Kansas, and he's a jazz columnist for eMusic.com. He reviewed McCoy Tyner Quartet on the Half Note label. The film The Graduate was released 40 years ago, and now there's an anniversary DVD edition. Coming up, our critic-at-large John Powers compares his impressions of The Graduate then and now. This is Fresh Air.
Thank you.
The Graduate. It's the movie that made Dustin Hoffman a star and established Mike Nichols as a film director. It's been 40 years since it opened, and now there's a new anniversary DVD. Our critic at large, John Power, sat down and watched it again after all these years.
I was a sophomore in high school when The Graduate first opened, and I still remember sitting in that Omaha theater and feeling a new kind of thrill wash over me. I'd loved many movies before, but this was the first one that seemed to have been made just for me. In thinking this, of course, I was like millions of others who thought exactly the same thing, which is one reason The Graduate instantly became a touchstone that helped define a whole era. I went to see it again and again during its first run, maybe 10 times in all. But protecting its place in my memory, I didn't watch it again until recently, when I got the 40th anniversary DVD. I popped the disc into the player with trepidation, but from the opening strains of Simon and Garfunkel singing "Hello, Darkness, My Old Friend," I was hooked and relieved. The Graduate still plays like gangbusters. Wonderfully directed by Mike Nichols, it's funny and staged with startling vividness. Back then, Hollywood directors were cribbing great visual ideas from European art movies. No doubt you know the story. A sly, fresh-faced Dustin Hoffman plays Benjamin Braddock, who returns home from college to the L.A. of sunshine and swimming pools. Everybody is pushing him towards a prosperous middle-class future, famously captured in a single word of advice: plastics. But Ben wants something more authentic, and he finds it in the form of Elaine Robinson. That's Catherine Ross, the co-ed daughter of his father's partner. But there's one huge stumbling block. Ben's having an affair with her mother, the worldly alcoholic Mrs. Robinson, played with indelible foxiness by Anne Bancroft, whose crossing and uncrossing legs are as eloquent as any monologue. Her scenes with Ben are modern classics, like this early one, when she invites the naive graduate back to her house, and he starts to panic.
Oh, my God.
Pardon?
Oh, no, Mrs. Robinson. Oh, no.
What's wrong?
Mrs. Robinson, you didn't expect...
What?
I mean, you didn't really think I'd do something like that.
Like what?
What do you think?
Well, I don't know.
For God's sake, Mrs. Robinson. Here we are. You got me into your house. You give me a drink. You put on music. Now you start opening up your personal life to me and tell me your husband won't be home for hours.
So?
Mrs. Robinson, you're trying to seduce me. Aren't you?
Watching The Graduate again flooded me with old passions, all that anxious isolation and thwarted romanticism. But I couldn't help noticing things that had escaped my teenage eyes. Despite hitting the zeitgeist, the movie was actually a bit behind the times. Based on a novel from 1963, a different cultural era, really, it celebrates a brand of timid, youthful innocence that many of Ben and Elaine's contemporaries were happily shedding. In fact, The Graduate represents a fundamental step in the media's domestication of what we think of as the 60s. The movie came out in the days of civil rights marches, Vietnam protests, and the Summer of Love. But none of these appear here. Even when Ben chases Elaine to Berkeley, ground zero of student radicalism, you get nothing more than shots of picturesque quads and a gruff landlord asking him if he's an agitator. Ben says no, and he's right. You see, he and Elaine are ciphers who don't stand for anything more than a generational rejection of their parents' inauthenticity. It was easy for many of us to project our own vague feelings of alienation onto Ben and Elaine because their rebellion didn't make any demands, didn't confer any responsibilities, didn't prove irrevocable. Their rebel attitudes often looked dangerous or apocalyptic, but in their way, they proved as safely suburban as what we were all rebelling against. Small wonder that so many iconoclastic young boomers like Ben and Elaine would turn into middle-aged bourgeois bohemians. I now grasp that the real outlaw is, of course, Mrs. Robinson, who, caught on the era before women's lib, tries to escape the velvet prison of housewifery in ways that boys like me found very scary. Although she's by far the film's most interesting character, I'd pick her over the bland Elaine anytime. It betrays her by turning her into a petty villain who curses like a fishwife when Ben crashes Elaine's wedding. And we're not supposed to care because The Graduate sides with Ben and Elaine. They're the young ones, and that's what matters. Maybe so, but today she's the character who now feels the most daring, the most unconventional, and the most human. She's the real rebel without a cause. I know I'm saying this 40 years too late, but here's to you, Mrs. Robinson.
John Powers is film critic for Vogue. You can download podcasts of our show by going to our website, freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Ian Chillog, Patty Leswing, Sam Brigger, and Jonathan Minhivar. I'm Terry Gross.
And here's to you, Mrs. Robinson. Jesus loves you more than you will know. Mrs. Robinson, heaven holds a place for those who pray. Hey, hey, hey. Hey, hey, hey. We'd like to know a little bit about you for our files. We'd like to help you learn to help yourself. Look around you, all you see are sympathetic eyes. Stroll around the grounds until you feel at home. And here's to you, Mrs. Robinson. Jesus loves you more than you will know. Whoa, whoa, whoa. God bless you, please, Mrs. Robinson. Heaven holds a place for those who pray.
Support for NPR comes from Broadway Books, publisher of Bill Bryson's memoir, The Life and Times of the Thunderbolt Kid, now in paperback. And from Endless Pools, swimming machines designed for exercise, fitness, and fun. DVD at 888-882-SWIM or endlesspool.com. CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's Loose at 1-877-21-FRESH. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, an important story in the development of the global jihad movement. We talk with journalist Yaroslav Trofimov about the 1979 siege of Mecca. He describes it as the first explosion of Sunni Islamist violence in the modern world and a prelude to Al-Qaeda's outrages. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.